Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Last week, we got through the D as in Delta section. This week, we're going to do the E as in Echo section. And we're going to start with ebook tools, because that's the first one in the list. So ebook tools gives you a couple of tools to help you deal with EPUB. What's the official pitch? The official pitch of the package is that tools for accessing and converting various ebook file formats. That may well be, but really what I use it for is einfo. That's the command that it provides. There are three header files, epub.h, epub_shared.h, epub_version.h, and I imagine you could do a lot of things with those header files. There's also a library, libepub.so, so I'm sure that would help a programmer use these, you know, like definitions of EPUB and construct EPUBs. Honestly, I have been, well, when I first started making EPUBs, I just made it myself. Like, it's not actually that hard, which is a beautiful thing about EPUB. You remember in the previous episode, possibly, I was talking about DJVU, and how kind of not easy it was to make compared to, say, a comic book archive where you just dump a bunch of pictures in a folder and say, that's an archive now. I mean, literally, you just zip it up and call it a .cbz, and it is a comic book archive then. Really, really nice. I mean, the images that you dump into a folder need to be sequential. You know, you have to give them numbers so that by default, they're sorted correctly. But other than that, I mean, that's the creation process. DJVU, a little bit difficult. EPUB is not terribly difficult. I mean, I say that because it sort of fits into my workflow anyway. I try to maintain a workflow based around DocBook in some way. And lately that has involved a lot of ASCII doc, because ASCII doc is essentially like a Common Mark, or better known as Markdown, a Common Mark kind of lightweight, you know, light markup language or Markdown language, that compiles down to, or transpiles, I guess, over to DocBook. And then DocBook you can do anything with, because it's a very, very verbose, very explicit language. So you got DocBook, and then you can go out to anything. You can put it out to an EPUB. You can just go out to HTML, and then literally making an EPUB like by hand, if you want to, it's just taking a bunch of HTML files, placing them in a directory, putting I think two different files of metadata are like sort of required. You can go further, but I mean, really, you only need two files of metadata, and one is, I mean, it's quite a trivial amount. I don't exactly remember all the things that you need to put in the file, but it is not a lot. And then you zip it up and you call it an EPUB. Now you have to declare the MIME type in an uncompressed section of that zip file that you've just created. So it's two different zip commands. It's one zip command to create a zip with zero compression, and then another zip command, ideally, to create the rest of the book that is compressed. So that's a little bit, I don't know, not counterintuitive, but like unintuitive. It's a secret that you have to know. And I've covered this before. I should probably have a link somewhere on how to do that. But I mean, realistically, you don't need to. I'm just saying, EPUBs are not difficult to make. That they're a little bit more complex than a comic book archive, but not that much harder. I mean, and it's HTML on the inside. So if you can create a website, then you can create an EPUB easier, to be honest, because really EPUB ideally would be a lot less formatted than most websites. So really basic HTML markup, a couple of fancy tricks with zip, and I think there might be some really rudimentary XML in there, but it is not hard. So this ebook tools thing, I'm sure, is very useful if you want to do all of that from the programmatic side. Like if you're programming something in C to create EPUBs or to look at them and you know, parse them and spit them out so that they look nice, this is probably very useful. For people who are not doing that, the little, I guess it's probably a demo application or something, it's called eInfo, and it's just, it gives you all the metadata about the book, a book, an EPUB file. So here's eInfo, and then I'm going to do a path to an EPUB that I literally just bought this morning, actually, on Humble Bundle, because there's a Java programming Humble Bundle. And so here's eInfo to javachallenges.epub, and it gives me about a screen full of information. So it gives me the file name, like where it exists on the system. That's just like confirmation of what you're looking at. And then the root sort of definition of what you're looking at, oebps/package.opf, that's application/oebps-package+xml, title, Java Challenges 100 plus proven tasks that will prepare you for anything, creators, Michael Inden, identifiers, URIN:ISBN:978-1-4842-7395-1, and so on. It also gives you the reading order, so it's not file names, but it's like, it tells you, like, if you open this up, these are the chapters and sections you are going to journey through in this order. And predictably, it's like, you know, front matter, chapter 1, part 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, part 2, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and so on. So it's pretty predictable. It's all just sort of, you know, sensible. But, it depends on how people name their files as to whether it's actually that obvious. And then there's other stuff, too, like the cover. Well, that's in HTML/cover.xhtml. Table of contents, that's in a different file. Body matter, that's over here in this different file, and so on. So it's really useful, kind of just, it's information about the book. It's metadata, it's data about the data. And the thing about that is that, you know, you can get this information by opening the EPUB, but what if you don't want to open an EPUB? And I will say that a lot of EPUB openers, a lot of EPUB readers, they seem to, and I don't know why this is, but a lot of them seem to assume that you want to create like a standing library for the, you know, like, I don't know how many PDF readers, none in my experience, but I'm sure there's a version of this, but I mean, how many PDF readers assume that you only want to open a book out of your PDF library? Like, you know, a library of books, not a coding library, but like, you know, usually it's just like, throw me a file, I'll show it to you. But EPUB readers, a lot of them just seem to want to insist that you have a stash of ebooks, of EPUBs, which, I mean, I do, but I don't always, I like to download EPUBs and then look at them, and then maybe I'll add it to my little ebook library. Maybe I won't. Maybe I want to file it away somewhere else. Maybe I don't care about it. Maybe I just want to get rid of it. I don't like that a lot of EPUB readers seem to just insist that it's the Elisa or Amarok of ebooks, if you take my meaning. You know, it's like, oh, you must have a stash of all of these books, and I must show you a gallery of the covers, and so on. Sometimes that's just not the case. So eInfo gets around that really easily. Although, now that I'm on the subject, there's a great Firefox extension called EPUB Reader that is really great. It you can just open up an EPUB right there in Firefox, which feels pretty natural because it's HTML. And there's a hidden toolbar at the top and a hidden toolbar at the bottom. That's the only, I would say, unintuitive thing. And it's really easy. You just open it up. It doesn't have any kind of concept of, let me show you all of your book covers so that you can choose which book you want to open. It's just, you throw it a file, it opens it and shows it to you. It's very nice. So I do recommend that one if you are looking for a quick EPUB reader. But if you're just looking for an easy way to just check out a EPUB file that you're not really sure what it is, eInfo is great. Now, if that metadata doesn't exist in the EPUB, eInfo fails miserably. Or it doesn't fail, but I mean, it will not give you the information that you'd hoped for. But that's not really its fault. That's the ebook publisher's fault. And it's easy to, like I say, I mean, EPUBs are easy to make. So it is easy to make an EPUB without all the right metadata. It really is. Just like it's easy to make any kind of file without the right metadata. It's like that extra step, which, I mean, admittedly is kind of bothersome and painful sometimes, but that's just the burden of digital content, I guess. Next package in the list is Editor Config, and this is a really... This is a great project. Editorconfig.org is the homepage. Well, I guess we should first, really quick, look at what's in the actual package itself. Editor config dash core. So this contains the editor config command itself, and then a bunch of CMake files. Looks like two different header files, and there it is, a library file. I can't for the life of me understand what the editor config command actually does. If I do a which on, well, if I do a which for editor config, it's in user bin. Okay. So if I do a file on that, it tells me that it is a, oh, darn it. That's a symbolic link to, okay, there we go, to an ELF binary called editor config. If you do sort of a dash dash help for editor config, then you get four options. The two of them are throwaway. Actually, three of them are throwaways. One is dash F, which requires the conf file name other than dot, you know, something dot editor config. So in other words, it's asking you for an alternate configuration file other than dot editor config. That's fine, except what does it do? Like, the command doesn't do anything that I can tell. So if I do editor config tilde slash ram disk slash fake, it just, nothing happens. It returns nothing. Now, is fake a valid editor config file? Well, yes, it is. I happen to have made a valid editor config file. We'll get to what editor config files do in a moment. But how about if I just do something completely fake? Like, so that doesn't exist. Non-existent. It's fine, too. It returns zero. So it will take fake file names just as happily as it will take true existent file names. I could also just put a string of letters, and then it gives me an error. It says input file must be a full path name. So as long as it's a path name, whether or not it exists, doesn't care, it's going to return zero. If it's not a path name, then it returns one. Is that the feature? Is that what this is for? I really don't know. So maybe the point is that I point it at fake and then give it a version number, because that's the dash B, specify version used by devs to test compatibility. Okay, it doesn't really tell me what the version is, but I'm assuming it's saying that the version number of another editor config release. So let's just go with 0.1. So dash B as in beta 0.1, and that returns the name of the path name, and then the option dash B, and then input file must be a path name. So it's interpreting my version number as an input file, which it isn't. And so, yeah, I don't know. The command doesn't seem to function in any sensible way. So I don't know what that does. Editor config itself, though, is a project that is intended to create a specification for IDEs, or I shouldn't say specification, a preference, preferences for an IDE. So let's say that you're programming in Python with a bunch of other people. Classic problem with Python is that some people use tabs and other people use spaces, and Python does not know, it knows the difference too well. If you have indented with spaces, and then someone goes into your code and indents with a tab, that breaks Python. That confuses a lot of people, because you go into Python, you look, everything's indented correctly. What's the problem? There's some number of invisible white space over here, and there's the same amount of white space over here. So how is that a broken issue? Well, if you know what to look for, or rather, if you know that the problem exists, you may poke around and discover eventually that, oh, these are all spaces, that one's a tab. That's why Python sees this as some kind of broken indentation. So that's really annoying. And it's not something that necessarily everyone has immediate control over, because if your editor is swapping out, has it programmed to look at four spaces and swap it out for a tab automatically, that's a convenience function of some editors. And the reverse is also true. For some editors, hitting tab gives you four spaces rather than the same width of four spaces, a single width of four space. So that can be really problematic. And that's just one example. I mean, there's lots of other examples, probably less maybe drastic, but variation can be a problem. It can be problematic. And I think one thing that I have discovered as I have worked with people and computers, or actually, you know what, just people and algorithms, because this happens in the little hobbyist game design stuff I do as well. I think as a programmer or a provider of a service, very frequently your tendency is to highlight how robust and flexible the thing that you're doing is. And you tell people, you tell your users, you can do this or you can do that. It doesn't care. My algorithm is smart enough to handle either one. It's a point of pride, and it should be. I mean, that's great design. If you've designed something that scales up, scales down, normalizes spaces versus tabs, like, that's really cool. But what I've discovered is that you don't need to give humans permission to deviate from a standard. If you find yourself writing in a program, in documentation for a program or a game, or whatever, if you find yourself writing, telling your reader that here's how you think they should do it, but if there's some other way that they can do it, that's fine. Don't ever do that. People know that if they can find another avenue to the same result, then they'll take it. And the moment you give them permission to do it, you are inviting variation. Now, you may think that your algorithm can withstand variation, and it might be able to, but that's the thing about variation, right? Like, you don't know. There could be something that someone tries that breaks your algorithm, because you're inviting that in. You're saying, just figure it out. You'll find a way to make it do this, and that's fine. My algorithm's really smart. Well, great. But what about an algorithm based on your algorithm? So, for instance, in an editor, or in programming, rather, you think, you know what, my algorithm's really smart. I'm just looking for equal sign. Doesn't matter how far things are indented, whether there's a space around the equal sign or not. It's super flexible. I'm just looking for this one character, and then I'm gonna take the left and the right values, and that'll be the key and the key and the value pair on a line delimited. It's really easy, not a problem. This is super basic stuff. And so you champion that. You think that's, you're super flexible. You don't care. As long as it's line delimited and, separated by, well, I guess delimited also, by equal sign, then you can parse this config file or whatever. And then someone is using this concept, your concept, and thinking, well, what I really, all I really want are the keys. That's all I want. I never need the values. I just want to see what these users are using as keys so that I can do a thing and it'll do a different thing, you know, so fine. Well, that person thinks, this will be super easy, and I'll look for the start of the word, start of a line, all the way up to the first equal sign, and that'll be the key. I know this always. Well, what that person didn't know is that you've not written a specification, and as long as the line has an equal sign, it's fine. So some people are indenting things, some people are not indenting things, some people are putting, I don't know, equal signs in their keys, whatever, right? Like, all, there's mayhem. People are doing whatever they want because you said they could. And now people trying to parse the thing that you've sort of kind of defined are all of a sudden having to do five times the work to account for all the different variations that are possible because you didn't specify what you need precisely enough. And it feels oppressive almost, right? Like, my gosh, like, why would you define something for people? Why would you force them into one thing? Like, surely giving flexibility and accounting for it is better than being narrow and rigidly defined. And I think in computing and in a lot of things where you're trying to create, again, an algorithm, a sequence of behavior and results, I think, no, I actually, like, if you want predictability, the specification is important. So all of this to say, editor config provides a standard, a specification for how somebody, some developer, some user within your system says, this is how I'm going to do things. I don't care what editor you're using. I don't care what kind of special macros you have enabled. I don't care what you feel like doing. If you want to conform to the thing that I've started, then here are the rules you need to follow. And better yet, here are the rules that your IDE, that your text editor, can use to help you conform. So you have things like, it's a simple file, it's INI, so it is a square bracket to apply to certain things. So for instance, square bracket, asterisk, square bracket would apply to everything in a document. End underscore of underscore line equals LF. That's a Unix-style new line character at the end of every line. And a final, if insert underscore final underscore new line equals true, would insert a final new line at the end of every file, which is a relatively common requirement. Like YAML, actually, I think it is an error or is it just a warning if you don't put an empty space at the end? And I think Nginx? Is it the Nginx config file or something like that wants a new line? I could be wrong about that. Anyway, yeah, I think I'm wrong about that. But there's something else that I do on a server frequently that's always telling me, hey, you don't have a final new line. And then you could do like a square bracket asterisk dot curly brace js comma py curly brace square bracket. So now you're saying anything that ends in js or py char set equals utf-8. So now you're using utf-8 character notation with anything that ends in JS and Python and so on. You can do that down to file extensions. You can do it to exact file names. And I mean, there's a list of like, you know, valid functions and stuff. You can't just obviously just make stuff up. Like I didn't just make up, what was it, end underscore of underscore line. That's part of the specification of editor config itself. So that's where those come from. You can't just say, oh, I would really like people to use, I don't know, a dash instead of an underscore in, or an underscore instead of an underscore instead of camel case in variable names. And, you know, you can't just make something up and just say variable name use underscore equals true. Like that won't work. There has to be a function for that. And there may well be, I don't know. I haven't looked at the whole specification of the file format. But that's the configuration file, and you would then distribute that to all of your developers, all the people that are working on your project, or if it's just something online, you might include this with your source code so people get it. And then, ideally, people can use a editor that conforms or that uses itself editor config, and that's kind of the trick. So a bunch of them do it anyway, like Builder, GNOME Builder, or I don't know if it's called GNOME Builder, but Builder, it's associated with GNOME, and I think I want to say Flatpaks or maybe Podman, something containery, I think. That uses it. Gitte uses it. Gitea. Uses it. GitLab uses it. So the GitLab, I guess the in-browser editor, I guess. I'm not sure. Ktext editor uses it. So that's close to home here. GOGS, IntelliJ, PyCharm, Kakune, that's a modern kind of re-implementation sort of Vim, or I guess you could say inspired by Vim. Yeah, lots of different ones just kind of have it. Now, I will say, the IDE, the one IDE I guess I use really more than anything else is NetBeans. And NetBeans does not use it, although there's a plugin apparently for it. So I need to start doing that, I guess. I need to download the plugin and start using that. So there's Atom, which is now dead. So what's it called? Proton? No. Pulsar. Pulsar Editor is the new Atom editor. So that has a plugin apparently. Eclipse has a plugin. Emacs apparently has a plugin. Genie does. Gedit, Jedit, NetBeans, Notepad++, that's not really for Linux, but I know it's a very popular one. Vim has a plugin, of course, and yeah, there are a bunch of them that can use the editor config system. So if you're working with a bunch of people and you want to kind of encourage certain guidelines and requirements of a file, which is a great idea to do, then editor-config-core or editor-config is what you want to look into. Editor-config-core is the package on Slackware. I feel like I've gone on too long about things that aren't packages about Slackware. I've waxed and waned or whatever. So Eigen 3. Is that how you say it? E-I-G-E-N. It's the math thing. Eigen 3 is a C++ template library for linear algebra. That's like stuff like matrices, vectors, numerical solvers, and related algorithms. I don't know anything about math. I don't know about algebra. I know the word linear from video editing, or rather non-linear. So I guess linear would be the reverse of that. So that's Eigen. And yeah, you should go check that out if you're into the maths. I am not. I'm really not very good at maths. I'm still trying to catch up on that. So I'm going to skip over that because I don't know what I would even do with it in C++. If I were to write a demo application, it would be horribly basic because that's where my math is. Elfutils. Elfutils is a collection of utilities, including stack to show stack traces, nm to show symbols from object files. We've used some of these, I think. Size for listing the section sizes of an object or archive file, strip for discarding symbols, readelf. Yeah, we've used all of these things in our talks about GCC. I mean, they're not very useful for building applications, but they're great for looking into an application, an ELF binary that obviously has been built by GCC, and maybe you need more information or you want more information, something like EU. All of these commands are prefaced by EU dash because they're part of ELF utils and not, you know, something else. And some of them are similar to some other edition of the tool, so or iteration of the same tool. So, or I don't know if it's iteration, a different version of a tool that does essentially the same thing. So, for instance, EU-object dump, EU-obj-dump, space, dash, dash, disassemble. That displays the assembly code of the binary, the ELF executable that you're looking at. So, for instance, let's do EU-obj-dump, dash, dash, disassemble, dash, slash, user, slash, bin, slash, editor, config, dash, 0.12.5. Let's see what we get from that. A whole bunch of output. So this is this looks about, it's, I don't know, 200 lines of code maybe, or outputs rather. So it's got the assembly codes I don't know what they're called, instructions. That's what I'm looking for. And it's vaguely meaningful if you understand assembly, which I don't. I mean, I know some of it, like push and move, XOR, moveal, things like that, but I don't really understand it. I just know that numbers are being shuffled around through memory, addresses and registries, things like that. So that's one example, one not very useful example. Well, I mean, it is useful if you know, if that's the kind of information you want, then that is useful. And there's quite a lot of code, quite a lot of commands here. Why isn't this working? Head dash in. There we go. So there's, for instance, EU dash adder to line, and that will take you, well, it'll look through the symbols and try to find the line number from where that symbol originates, I believe it is. EU-AR, that's an archiver. EU-ELF classify, ELF compare, ELF compress, ELF lint, and so on. And EU-NM, that's a useful one. I know that we've used that one. Oh, did I already mention that? I did mention that. Dash strings, dash strip, and so on. So tools to help you sort of analyze and possibly optimize in some cases, like strip, an ELF binary. Now, Slackware generally strips binaries anyway. So like EU dash, we wouldn't want to strip yet. We wouldn't want to strip, but we could do, for instance, EU dash NM, user bin editor config dash 0.12.5, and it returns there are no symbols available here. But I could download some source code, I could compile it, and then before stripping it, I could do -nm, and I would get a list of the symbols. And once you have a list of the symbols, you could also do like, well, I mean, I wonder if we could do strings. Let's do strings on editor config. Strings, plural, eu-strings. Yeah, couple of strings. There's --version, --help, unable to allocate memory, failed to read standard in. Couple of strings there. Not useful to me. But oh no, there's quite a lot of strings actually. I just missed half of them. A couple of function names or something like that. But again, doesn't tell me anything about what editor config is supposed to do. So I guess in other words, this isn't something that's going to help you, I don't think, like understand an application on the sort of how is it built level. It's gonna help you understand. I mean, I guess technically. It's all, you know, reverse engineering, I guess. But yeah, it's more for analyzing a binary that you've built and looking and seeing, you know, what's going on with it. Like, if it's erroring out, like, why? Where might, you know, what symbols are there? What symbols are missing? What symbols maybe aren't listed in a place where they're supposed to be? Symbols being reference points to a type of data, like a global variable. So if something's crashing and you suspect that it didn't get the data that it was supposed to get, then looking at the symbols might tell you, oh, that there's a global variable that I thought I set at the top of my program that all functions should have access to, but it's not here anywhere. It's not listed in the dyn sym table. It's in the sym tab, or it's in one and not the other, you know. So you could I guess come up with some theories on what's going wrong that way, but it's definitely a forensics type of tool set. Really useful stuff. I feel like we've used it before on this podcast, most of them, so I think that's probably enough said about that. We should go get coffee. Who doesn't love a good cup of coffee? I mean, I sure do. And I am sitting here with coffee looking through Mastodon posts that I have forgotten to mention. Actually, there's only one. Well, I mean, there's probably more, but the one that I remember that I forgot to mention is from Hacker Defo. He says, regarding episode 516, Plasma Vault offers a nice GUI and KDE integration for CryFS. Good to know. Didn't know that. Siri Kali, that's SiriKali, is another CryFS GUI that is cross-platform and desktop environment agnostic. That is, I'll just have to insert a link in the show notes to that. It's on a very long string, a name, I believe, .github.io/SiriKali, SiriKali. I'm sure a search engine could get you there too. I did take a look at that. That was really cool. Both of the above support other encryption methods besides CryFS. If someone is looking for something even easier, then Cryptomator is another solid choice. Cryptomator is free to use on Windows, macOS, and Linux, but not on iOS or Android. Cryptomator.org. So both of those, if I recall correctly, were open source. I don't remember there being one that wasn't. So yes, I'm going to go on record and saying both of them are absolutely GPL3. I'm pretty sure that's correct, actually. And yeah, they look kind of interesting, actually. I mean, CryFS, I was really impressed with just sort of the fact that it exists. In the previous episode, yeah, GPL3. The fact that it exists was kind of cool. I hadn't heard of it. And just the concept of lock up your stuff yourself and then put that on someone else's cloud. That way they probably can't get into it. There's a probably in there, obviously. I mean, you're still putting your stuff up on someone else's computer and given enough time and determination. You never know what's possible when you just have something sitting around someone else's place. But I would say probably could not get into that. I would feel pretty good about it myself. So yeah, it's a really neat little application, but there are front ends, and Hacker Defo has given us three. Plasma Vault, which I guess I must have. I mean, I didn't actually check. Plasma Vault. I don't know if I have that. I'm not sure if that's in my edition of KDE, to be honest. I'm going to system settings, and I don't know why I'm going there. I think because other OSs have, and maybe possibly GNOME, has their vault in system settings. I could be making that up. I don't see anything called Plasma Vault. So anyway, that exists, apparently, taking it on Hacker Defo's word. Plasma Vault, I mean, probably didn't just make it up. Plasma Vault exists, and you could use that for KDE and CryFS. Siri Kali, I took a look at that one. I thought that was really neat. And then Cryptomator looks really cool. I didn't get around to trying it. But yeah, those are three really cool little projects built up around quick and easy local encryption that you could then distribute everywhere because you alone have the key to that vault. That's everything for listener feedback, I think. So let's continue through the ease as an echo. Enchant is next. Enchant, I think, must be, I mean, it's from the Abbey Word project, from what I can tell. And it's a wrapper for spell checker utilities. So it uses, or it can use, I guess, Aspell, Ispell, Hunspell, Uspell, and Hspell. And I know that it's from Abbey Word because the repository, the Git repository, is abbeyword.github.io/enchant. And it is, yeah, it's a library and command program that wraps a number of different spelling libraries and programs with a consistent interface. The command line I could not really get to work. I mean, I could get it to respond, but I couldn't get it to actually do what I would expect a spell checker to do. So to try it out yourself, it would be enchant dash first, do enchant dash lismod dash 2, that's lsmod, like list mode, I guess, lsmod dash 2, the number 2. Do that, and it tells you what you have installed on your system. I have Hunspell and Aspell, apparently. I thought I had Ispell as well, but apparently not. Aspell. Hunspell and Aspell, and knowing that is just, it just confirms that, yes, you have dictionaries. Great. So now, in theory, enchant dash 2 should do something, so I'll create a quick file here called my bad spell, and I'll do hello Walder, comma, I am a hacker, KC instead of CK, and Gek, two K's instead of two E's. So lots of misspellings in that sentence, and then I'll do an enchant dash to my bad spell, and it tells me that I need to define a dictionary and then the file. So, okay, I thought it would sort of recognize the dictionary on its own, so apparently not. So I'll just do enchant dash to dash D for dictionary, and then slash user slash lib64 slash aspell slash British dot alias. I'm not British, but I live in a British country. Or, well, it's not British country. It's a country that has a history with British spelling. Space mybadspell.txt. Nothing. It just gives me more output. Now, there is a useful, I mean, like, it gives me the help menu. Maybe I could just give it just the name of the dictionary. No, still nothing. Okay. So there is an interesting option, though, that I do like, dash lowercase l. That lists only the misspellings. And it tells me, okay, it gives me an error this time. Couldn't create a dictionary for f slash user lib64. That's not what I said. Oh, it is. Okay. There we go. Maybe that was, no. Couldn't create a dictionary for slash users lib64 aspell British dot alias. Okay. Well, dash p says give the given personal word list. I don't have one, but could that be maybe where it would go for a personal dictionary? No, it is not. So yeah, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing with enchant that I'm not doing, but it will not give me sort of like output that makes sense. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a way to get it. Okay, well, now there's a way to do something at least, but that's not what I wanted to do. Enchant dash two dash lowercase l to list only the misspellings, and then mybadspell.txt. That lists on a line each word Walder, which should be world, Haker, which should be hacker, and Geek, which should be geek. So it recognized that those are the wrong spellings, but unfortunately, it doesn't tell me how to fix them. Now, there is a dash. I think it's what is it? Dash something option. I guess I have to look at the help file again, which I could only see whether I wanted to or not before. Now I'm looking for it. Okay, dash A list suggestions in iSpell pipe format mode. Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, so dash A. So it should be giving me suggestions from aSpell, from what I understand, or iSpell, but or aSpell rather. But it's not. So yeah, I'm not sure. I guess my best guess is that enchant dash two is a sort of a example library on how you would call the enchant library were you to be creating a command line tool, because that does not do it for me. That is not correcting spelling. Not the way that, for instance, just calling aspell my bad text does, or aspell dash c for check. Does. That steps you through, that interface that, as I said a couple of episodes ago, is exactly the reverse order of how Emacs does it. It's like A for accept, I for ignore, and I for insert versus A for something else. So yeah, that's weird. I don't know what the problem there is, but again, I'm assuming it's just because that terminal command itself not really designed to be useful. I hope that's it, because it is not useful. Next in the list is eSound, the enlightened sound demon. eSound with a capital D at the end. The enlightened sound demon is a server process that mixes several audio streams for playback by a single audio device. For example, if you're listening to music on a CD and you receive a sound-related event from your chat application, it's actually ICQ in this text. So that gives you a clue as to when. If the CD didn't clue you in, ICQ gives you an idea of when this was written. The two applications won't have to jockey for the use of your sound card. This is kind of what I was talking about last time when I was talking about whatever I was talking about. It must not have been last time. It must have been the time before. Either way, there was a time on Linux when, yeah, when when two different things were trying to claim the use of a sound card. The sound card essentially had to choose between which one it was going to let you hear. And that's a horrible user experience. This, for the record, was not. Well, I say it wasn't during my time. Technically, it was. There were instances where that would happen, but it was a relatively specialized thing. Like I would be running Jack and then something else. So yeah, it was a little bit different. But eSound was an early implementation of this concept of like, well, let's provide a little a green room, a buffer area for these sound signals to come in. We'll mix them together into one stream and send that stream to the sound card. Thinking of it as like a quick like chime sound and maybe a file that you're listening to on the internet, a 1 minute file, a 30 second file, that seems manageable to me. But the concept of like a CD streaming constantly for like an hour and then a chime happening at some unpredictable moment, the ability to mix that together and send it to a sound card at the speed of sound, that's just amazing to me. That's the kind of thing where computing just, it's magical, it's so cool. And of course, it's Enlightenment that would have done an early implementation of this. I mean, the Enlightenment desktop, if you've never used it, it's worth a look. It might not be worth like using long term. I have had stability issues with it, but it is really nice. And some of the ideas that Enlightenment has had over the years that then crop up in just mainstream Linux, just so cool. It really is. It's really neat. Okay, next up is eSpeak NG. eSpeak NG is a text to speech application. I'm gonna admit, it is not my favorite thing in the world. I mean, it's a fun thing if you think, oh, gee, it might be fun to hear some like cool retro computer speech like this.
This is cool retro computer speech delivered by SpeakNG.
But I mean, you have to admit, that's that isn't what I would call maybe, I don't know, user-friendly. I mean, you're lucky if you understood what that said, and maybe you did, but it is difficult, I think. I think it's difficult to understand that. It speaks, it's clipped, it's relatively fast, and it's quite harsh. And it's 2023, so I just feel like computers should sound a little bit more human. Maybe something like this.
This is Cool Modern Computer Speech delivered by Skoki.
Now that was the TTS Skoki. No, Skoki-AI TTS. So whatever. The Skoki-AI project, and the command is, and the Python library is TTS. The voice that you just heard was the Jenny model. That's kind of a cool project. You should check it out. Go to github.com/Skoki-AI, Skoki-AI/TTS, all TTS is all capitals. Everything else is lowercase. You can use you can install it with Python 3-m pip install TTS. That grabs a bunch of Python libraries, puts it into your home directory, and then you're kind of ready to go. You'll see documentation on how to like program Python with it in the README file. But you can also just try it on the in a terminal. And for instance, you might do something like TTS:\list_model. That gives you a big long list of all the different voices, the voice models, and the sound profiles that were trained on lots and lots of text and so on. But the nicest one I've found is the one that you just heard, Jenny. TTS:\models/en/Jenny/Jenny. Jenny is J-E-N-N-Y. So you put, TTS:\model_name:, TTS:\models/en/Jenny/Jenny, \text, and then the text that you want TTS to speak. This is Cool Modern Computer Speech delivered by TTS Skoki. \out_path Skoki.wav, for instance. That would produce a WAV file with the text that you just quoted. Now, you could do a cool little Python script to read a file, you know, line by line, or however you want to do it, and put that out to a WAV file. You could create a Python application to interact with you, much in the same way that eSpeak might. All in all, I have found all speech, text-to-speech on all computers, on all Linux computers, clunky. And I don't mean that the text-to-speech is clunky necessarily, not now with Skoki AI, for instance, but the integration seems clunky to me. And I don't know if it's just something, and this could very well just be me not understanding where everything is supposed to go, and then how to access it, but to me, it seems like there's a big learning curve. And I'm not saying that's unreasonable. Learning curves are reasonable. Like, if you don't know how to do something and you want to learn how to do something, there's a learning curve there. Even if it's just a straight line from point A to point B, you have to learn it. So that's not unreasonable. I'm just saying I haven't yet figured it out myself, really. I mean, I could not. If you custom ordered, I don't know why you would custom order anything from me, but if you did and you said, hey, I need a laptop that'll talk to me, I wouldn't really know how to do that. I mean, I could drum up something specifically that works if you stay in Emacs, because there's a module for Emacs to speak out like things through the Festival voice synthesizer using eSpeak as the driver, and it's clunky and it's awkward, and it doesn't feel like it's really a thing yet. And I would love for it to be a thing, and I think Skoki-AI TTS is the way. I mean, that sounds amazing, and it's all open source, so I don't know, that would be the thing to integrate if I had to choose. Then again, I think there are different voices available for other speech synthesizers too. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. All I know is that it seems to be a big sort of place full of potential. And I you know, there's part of me that wants to really dive into it. And then there's part of me that obviously doesn't want to, because I haven't yet. So, I mean, there must be something about that is not compelling me to dive right in. But I don't know. It is something to think about. It is an exciting developing thing. I mean, you heard the difference between eSpeak and Cookie. So, I mean, there's growth there. It's exciting. It's very, 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 very cool and full of potential. But it is something that you're going to have to look into. Exiv 2, EXIV 2. This is a tool that I don't actually use myself all that often. Let's go to Unsplash really quick and grab an image. I will just literally take this one here because it's on the front page. Grab that, download it to RAM disk, and then I'm going to do Exiv 2 on this, what did I just download? I don't know. TOM. Okay. So Exiv 2 on TOM JPEG. File name is a big long string. The file size is a number of bytes. The MIME type is image JPEG, and the image size is 1920 by 2880. And interestingly, none of that is EXIF data. That's all just auto-detected properties of the image file. So if you want to do some EXIF data, it's actually, I don't know, I find it difficult in EXIF 2. I don't use EXIF 2, I use EXIF tool. What I'm saying is EXIF, EXIV as in Victor 2 versus EXIF, EXIF as in Foxtrot tool, all one string. EXIF tool doesn't ship with Slackware. It's available in slackbuilds.org, though, and I find it much, much easier to use. EXIV 2, though, is what I'm talking about, and so EXIV 2, the one command I could get to actually work is EXIV 2 space dash capital M, quote, set space EXIF with a capital E dot photo with a capital P dot user comment, U and C both capital there, and then space, I don't know, car set equals ASCII new EXIF comment close quote, and then the path to the image. That works. And if I do EXIV 2 space image name, example.jpg, let's say, then now I've got EXIF data. So there's the standard EXIF stuff, camera make, camera model, image timestamp. None of those are populated, of course, because they're just EXIF data that I haven't given it. The one that is populated is EXIF comment. Now, confusingly, notice the property within the namespace EXIF, the property that was modified, that we modified in that command, was EXIF.photo.userComment. But when you list the tags, and this kills me, when you list the data, the metadata, you get things like EXIF comment. So if you're trying to reverse engineer from the output what you might change that comment to, or how you could change that comment, you would think, well, EXIF 2 dash capital M for modify, presumably, quote, set EXIF.comment, probably, right? And then a comment. And I don't know why the example is car set equals ASCII new EXIF. What a horrible example that is. A comment would be something like, this is my vacation photo. That's a comment. Car set equals ASCII space new space EXIF space comment is a horrible example. Okay, so now I've just set it to this is my vacation photo, but again, I had to know that it was EXIF.photo.userComment. Well, I guess that's technically easy enough. You just go look at the EXIF data specification to find out what all those tag names are. But I find it puzzling that the output of a command would disguise the thing that you put in. I mean, I understand maybe not wanting to put too many dots in there because dots scare some people, but okay, swap them out for spaces and then just say, okay, there's a space, you put a dot when you're setting the thing. And that took me a long time to figure out that alone. I mean, like, camera model isn't what you would think it would be. Like you'd think, well, exif.camera.model, I guess? And then we could just say, it's a Canon, maybe. No, that's an error. Manipulate the EXIF metadata of images. That's what this command does, but that's an error. Invalid key, EXIF camera. Well, how do we list keys, then? Well, man EXIF 2... do a search for list. Short answer, that won't give you like a magical list of all the possible EXIF keys. And that's because there isn't like one possible set of EXIF keys. There's camera manufacturers out there that implement vendor specific tags and so on. So it's really a mess, all the metadata possibilities of images, unfortunately. And And it's, I think it's to the detriment of the user and to the detriment of the tool, because this tool is, you know, unintentionally frustrating. It's not, I don't think it's the tool's fault. I think it's just, there's a lot of metadata possibilities out there. And yes, you could write anything to the file, but then would anything be able to read that back to you in a useful way? You obviously don't want to encourage, or rather you don't, it's probably not realistic for you to want to just write arbitrary data to an image file as metadata. That seems silly. So that's not what EXIF 2 is primarily designed to do. Although you can, there's a namespace specifically for EXIV, that's EXIV as in Victor, and you could write stuff to that all day. But would that be useful? Maybe not. So the place I go to, ironically, to get EXIF metadata information is exiftool.org, which is a different command. It's available on slackbuilds.org. I find it much easier to use than EXIV 2, and I would recommend installing that. exiftool.org/tag names/exif.html is the list of all the EXIF tags, but it's messy. There's no getting around it. It is messy. There's a lot of potential metadata out there, and it's a rather strict list of potential, well, keys and values, because again, you want things with like firmware and stuff to be able to read that stuff back to you in a useful way. You want your camera to understand the metadata. You don't want to just throw it random values and pretend like firmware that's very hard-coded for exactly a specific set of metadata to just roll with it. So that's EXIV 2. I don't mean to give it, I don't mean to rob it of any kind of meaningful attention, but I don't use it. I find EXIF tool a lot more user-friendly. EXIV 2, however, has a whole library set so that if you are writing this data with your C++ program or something, well, you've got a library for that now, and that is quite useful. All right, last one in the E section, XPAT. It's a C library for parsing XML. Not a whole lot more to say about that. XML is a great format, but parsing it can be complex. Like if you're trying to do it manually, I don't know if you've ever tried to parse XML or even HTML in like a shell script or with grep, you know, or with awk. It's just horrible. I mean, just look up on like Stack Overflow how to do that sort of thing. You can do it. It can be done, but, and you'd think it would be easy. I mean, in theory it is, right? You find the greater than and then the less than, and the stuff in between those two should be the data, but there are all kinds of exceptions, and then there's the attributes within each element and so on. So it can be very difficult. So XPAT, making it easier for a C programmer to parse XML. Who's going to argue? Nobody. That's the E section. E as in echo. Done. On to F as in Foxtrot next week. Thanks for listening. Talk to you then.